Time now for Simon Evans and his Jokenomics lecture on our addictions. This week, the newly demonized commodity, sugar.
Welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market. Welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market, the nation's only intentionally funny show about economics, and I have to say intentionally to distinguish it from any TV show Robert Peston appears on with that new bohemian hairstyle of his. Economics is a glimpse into how our minds work, how our neighbours work, and even how our 18 personal Chinese wage slaves work, even if we'd really rather not know. This series, we're talking about the markets in addictive substances. And this week, we've come to the cuckoo in the nest. And what a big fat cuckoo it is. Sugar. Sugar is not a drug, of course, except as a coded reference to heroin in certain old songs that balding mojo readers will explain to you if you buy them a pint of old Twiggy. Sugar is not even a gateway drug, though if you eat enough of it, they might eventually have to put a gateway in the wall of your bedroom to get you out. But sugar does seem to be addictive. No one has ever eaten just one Malteser, have they? Trying to eat one Malteser is like trying to just do the first meter of a skydive. And it's beginning to look very nearly as dangerous too. We have long explained its dangers to children in terms of tooth decay. Don't eat too much sugar, we tell them. It'll make your teeth fall out. Or in the case of my hyperactive little tykes, get knocked out. A risky argument, though, tooth decay, as there is a powerful incentive for children to loosen their teeth without delay. The Tooth Fairy provides kids with an opportunity to trade their own body parts long before they can open an eBay account of their own. If you tell kids that eating sweets will make their teeth fall out, all they hear is ringing cash registers. This is where economic understanding is your friend. Tell them that sugar will undermine the value of their teeth when they do fall out, and that the Tooth Fairy will no more pay for a sugar-decayed molar than I would for a second-hand gum shield, and that'll slow them down a bit. But the Tooth Fairy may in fact be a red herring, though that is an image you won't find on much nursery bed linen. Because to sugar's familiar charges of tooth decay, hyperactivity, and making things my children handle sticky, is now added metabolic syndrome, a raft of life-threatening conditions such as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and diabetes, which together take 3 million lives annually worldwide. And unfortunately, they're not all children. Metabolic syndrome correlates closely... We wondered whether you'd go for that one. Metabolic syndrome correlates closely with obesity and is now second only to tobacco as a global health risk. We have now arrived at a situation where more people worldwide die from being fat than from being thin. Sugar is in almost everything now. Empty your cupboards of food containing sugar and your kitchen will quickly start to resemble a Zimbabwean supermarket. For the love of donut, did we get here? Well, as Bill Clinton wisely said, it's the economy, stupid. Although he also said, for God's sake, Hillary, we can't both be president. And indeed, damn it, Monica, I'll never get it to light now. But still... Joining me to unpick the trail, as ever, is the BBC's number one economic whiz kid. At least he was, until good old Whiz became yet another victim of the government's poorly informed and draconian anti-drug legislation. He's Radio 4's host from More or Less and regular FT columnist. Please welcome Tim Harford. Now, Tim, you are a fit young bloke, and I am telling the audience at home that because when you say economist on the radio, some people picture a balding, hunched figure struggling to keep a pipe lit as dandruff spreads across the shoulders of his loosely belted 70s leather jacket. But you're not like that at all, yet. So, just before we get started, on a personal level, do you struggle with sugar addiction?
I have a really sweet tooth, Simon. I love donuts, I love cakes, I love chocolate, but fortunately I'm still quite slim, so there's an economics lesson in there.
Oh, is there? What is that then?
Life's not fair, but I'm doing okay, so I don't care.
Yeah. That is indeed the bottom line. I also need to introduce at this point my series guinea pig, Andy, the blank slate on which to scribble the economic impact of sugar. Now, Andy, I believe you've genuinely not eaten any sugar for quite some time. Is that right?
Well, basically, since we started doing the research for this show.
Well, that's nearly a month now. I thought not eating sugar was supposed to make you look healthy.
But I have been working with you for all that time.
We're going to start you off with a donut, honey and chocolate combo. You've got those three items there, a kind of sugar buffet. It's one part American cop, one part Winnie the Pooh and one part teenage girl who's just been dumped. You have been going without sugar for a month, Andy. Our current consumption of sugar here in the UK is over 30 kilograms per person per year. That is roughly a whole bag every 12 days and more than four times what it was 100 years ago. We thought it was about time that your consumption caught up with the rest of us. So get that lot down your neck and we will discuss the chemistry of this substance. Sugar, for our purposes, is any product which contains in roughly equal balance molecules of glucose, which is the body's ultimate source of energy, and fructose, which is mainly there to make you fat and give you diabetes. It's not always called sugar, of course. In fact, there are over 50 different words for sugar currently doing business in British food labelling. Sugar is to us what snow is to the Eskimo. Aliases include agave nectar, barley malt, blackstrap molasses, and so on. All very handy, of course, if you hope to hide its presence from all but the most eagle-eyed of harassed mothers. And it is certainly not possible to use common sense to determine whether a food product like Mrs. Bakerwife's traditional sweet and sour venison Wellington might contain more or less sugar than a custard donut. In my experience, the only way to discover whether or not a food product contains too much sugar is to give it to your kids and see if they ask to have it again. If they do, it does. Tim, I believe there are some economic principles about how small you have to make the type to avoid it being red and the difficulties of encouraging people to eat healthily and so on.
Well, there's this field of behavioural economics, which is basically trying to apply psychological ideas to economic policy. And one of the things they're trying to do now, it's because the small print doesn't work very well, they're introducing what they call a traffic light system. The trouble is, think about Coca-Cola. It's low in salt, it's low in fat, it's low in saturated fat. So when you look at Coca-Cola on the supermarket shelves, there were three green lights there. It goes to show how difficult it is to get this labelling right.
We need to talk about the history and the context of sugar to understand how it's become so prevalent, because for most of recorded history, of course, there was no food industry, and indeed there was no obesity. Whether or not that's coincidence, we'll find out. There was often not enough food to get fat on, and when there was, you ate it all, and then you got thin again when it ran out. This was, of course, especially true of seasonal goods like fruit, and they were only around for a month or two at a time. You rarely saw obese humans in much the same way that you rarely see an obese squirrel. And if you do, it's probably Dom Jolly. Your tastes were of no importance. Economics determined your meal. The toffs might enjoy the odd imported delicacy, but it would probably have gone off by the time they got to it and they wouldn't know the difference. Hence, brie. In Britain, in the Bronze Age, if you were unhappy gnawing on a parsnip, you go hungry. Breakfast, parsnip. Lunch, parsnip. Birthday, candle in a parsnip. But when spices were discovered, of course, immense fortunes were made because these could be shipped without perishing, and then you could have a spicy parsnip. Historically, sugarcane first appeared in Papua New Guinea, very close to the Spice Islands, in fact, which are a small archipelago made up of Ginger Spice Island, Sporty Spice Island, and Posh Spice Island, which is where they keep the saffron. But throughout my childhood, sugar, however popular, was essentially visible and upfront, however. It's not that you couldn't eat too much, but you would generally know what you were up to. The first nation to really buck this trend was, of course, America.
Yes, this really began in 1971. So you had Richard Nixon. He was a man so key to understanding the present-day ubiquity of sugar that really Frost Nixon shouldn't have been a play, it should have been a serving suggestion. Nixon's problem was that American voters were worried about high food prices, and so he got this man in to try to sort out America's agriculture. The agriculture secretary was a man called Earl Butts. He persuaded farmers to grow almost exclusively corn and to grow corn on vast scales, both as cheap human fodder and to feed cattle to make cheap meat and high fructose corn syrup.
But even now, there was still one more piece of Lego to fit into the soft white underfoot of humanity's health. It's a lovely confluence of influences, this. There have been a row for some years in medical circles about rising rates of heart disease, and it was agreed that the cause was furry arteries, which, of course, sound cute, like Furbies, but are, in fact, potentially lethal to middle-aged men. Again, like Furbies. What wasn't agreed was which element of our diet was causing our arteries to fur. Now, it would be very easy to portray this dispute as a battle between honourable British scientific work in the tradition of Alan Turing and Doctor Who and commercially tainted American pseudoscience in the style of Dr. Phil and Flubber. So, let's do that. The British scientist in question was John Yudkin, and he had published a seminal work many years previously entitled Pure, White and Deadly, firmly identifying sugar as the culprit of many modern diseases. He questioned why sugar made rats and indeed humans, on the rare occasions he was allowed to experiment on them, basically eat until they burst. And he thought this might be an issue worth addressing. However, American nutritionist Ansel Keys had conducted a study into blood cholesterol levels around the world compared to the consumption of fat in that part of the world. The seven countries he famously illustrated his conclusive anti-fat theory with were culled from 22 that he had actually studied, the other 15 of which, irritatingly, did not support his thesis and so were casually dumped. This is a matter of record now. For instance, he disregarded the Inuit or Eskimo people, who may have 50 words for snow, but have only one for food, which is blubber. And yet, they have heart attacks about as often as they strip off for hot dog leg selfies by the fishing pool. Eating fat makes you fat. As a rigorous scientific hypothesis, this was up there with such research papers as He Who Smelt It Dealt It and Beans, Beans, Good for the Heart. Predictably, however, the Yanks lapped it up, and pausing only to traduce poor John Yudkin for his silly obsession with good old American sugar, they launched the War on Fat. Well, the War on Fat was about as successful as most of America's other wars against abstract notions and non-state-maintained militia. Tim.
The message was sent out to eat carbohydrates instead of eating fat, and unfortunately, most Americans focused on the eat carbohydrates bit more than the instead of eating fat bit. So they began to expand like human weather balloons without showing any appreciable improvement on the heart attack front. So then the government pressed the food industry to offer low-fat alternatives to regular food. And this is where the food industry got really clever. So the food industry realised low-fat is actually a great business opportunity. Selling overpackaged food-like substances at twice the price of actual food seems like a tough sell. But if you can say, well, this is a new low-fat version of actual food, then you have a good reason why you're playing for a microwavable box with a cartoon monkey on the front. Ka-ching!
Now, this is interesting because the trouble is, if you remove fat from food, you also remove the taste. Fat is where the taste lingers on the tongue, and it's almost as if nature intends us to eat the stuff. It's weird, huh? So, in order to make fatless food edible, let alone tasty again, they added sugar. Or rather, because US farmers were now growing vast quantities of corn and it was mounting up all over the place, they added a new sugary corn extract called high fructose corn syrup, which was basically sugar at two-thirds the price. Is that right?
That is right. And people took to high fructose corn syrup, or rather manufacturers did, in an awful hurry. So between the mid-1970s and around 1990... the amount of sugar consumption in the States that was high fructose corn syrup went up from about 5% to nearly 50%. So high fructose corn syrup basically cornered the sugar market.
Suddenly, America has now created the perfect food storm, even better than the one in Animal House. They had welcomed in their deadliest foe. They were pumping it into their foods like there was no tomorrow, which for millions of newly diabetic Americans was alarmingly plausible. And they were marketing it, initially at least in good faith, as the healthy option. This is extraordinary. This was the first time that sugar, even in America, was so prevalent in all four courses of a meal. The starter, the main course, the dessert, and the drink. Finally, it had arrived. The four-course menu of the apocalypse. Thank you. If I told you that the entire series has basically been building up to that line, I wouldn't be exaggerating by much. But so whereas before Americans used to eat until they were full and then maybe just a little bit more for luck, now they ate without ceasing, and it all comes down to fructose. Half of regular sugar and half of high fructose corn syrup is fructose, and the biochemistry of fructose in humans is complex, even by biochemical standards. I could attempt an explanation, but to be honest, on radio and hopefully at home, a couple of glasses to the good by now, chances are, much like your mitochondria when confronted by the stuff, you won't absorb it. So, here is a marginally oversimplified bottom line. Due to the nature of insulin, leptin, and your poor, overworked hypothalamus, your body, it seems, does not metabolize fructose in the same way it does every other molecule of carbohydrate. It struggles to make sense of it. And so while it packs it onto your liver as fat to deal with later, you simultaneously don't know you've eaten it and desperately want some more. And that is the genius of fructose. It is built-in obsolescence as food. The minute you've eaten it, you need an upgrade. Meanwhile, it makes everything taste so damn palatable, it just isn't worth bothering to do anything else to make food appealing. If you're the food industry, this is such a win-win situation. And it is, to be fair, the spirit of the age everywhere. Why bother writing a decent movie when CGI can make a crap one sell perfectly well? Why bother writing a new song when you can sample an old one and do some mumbling over it? Tim, I believe you have an economic theory that accounts for this as well.
This idea is adverse selection. The classic example of adverse selection is the second-hand car market. So you've got second-hand cars that work perfectly well, and you've got second-hand cars that don't work well. And the trouble is, the seller knows which are the good ones and which are the bad ones, and the buyer hasn't got a clue. So they won't be willing to pay much for them. The same thing, I think, is true of high fructose corn syrup and other sugars in food. They make the food taste better. We can't tell whether they're in the food or not very easily. And there's absolutely no mileage in the food industry making, you know, good, honest food that actually tastes nice, because we can't tell the difference.
It's a hard thing to get your head around conceptually, even here, where we haven't been exposed to the propaganda. But if fat is good and sugar is bad, we need to start dropping words like sweet to describe sweet little girls and use the word fat instead. It's going to be a brave person who tries it out the first time. Just one more example of how the hip-hop community is light years ahead of us, of course. Time to go over to see how Andy is getting on. I've been hearing very agreeable and promising chomping sounds in my left ear. How do you feel now, Andy? You've got through a donut, you've had a couple of biscuits?
I've had two donuts, half a packet of biscuits, and a third of the pack of chocolate.
Marvellous.
I feel really happy.
And hungry? Do you feel hungry?
I'm really hungry.
It's important experimentally that you feel hungry. We're going to fake those results if they don't come through. But now, chocolate and honey is a very British approach to sugar. So we're going to move you on to something more all-American now. I've got something over here. I don't know if any of you have children. These are something called Fruit Loops. Fruit there is spelt F-R-O-O-T. I imagine for much the same reason that Iron Brew isn't spelt as if it actually contains ferrous metals. But the Kellogg's website says that they are a fun part of a complete breakfast. So it's either Fruit Loops or porridge on a bouncy castle. Your choice. Incredibly, there is a non-sugar version as well, which is actually just some colouring pencils and a hole punch. Anyway. Now, one person who would disapprove of my experimenting with poor old Andy is David Gillespie, who's author of the book Sweet Poison, Why Sugar Makes Us Fat. I started by asking him how he views sugar.
Sugar is, I guess, a lethal and highly addictive substance that's been added to our food supply without our consent. Manufacturers pretty quickly figured out that we really, really love it and that we will be much more likely to buy something if it's got a lot of sugar in it. And so they keep obliging us and putting more and more sugar in it.
That's not just children, that's adults as well. You think we're all addicted equally?
Oh, absolutely. It's the only highly addictive substance that we give to two-year-olds and one-year-olds and 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds. It's embedded in our food supply so substantially now that it is almost impossible to avoid it.
So sugar is the only thing that babies like as much as adults, except, of course, breasts, which might explain Kellogg's new Sugar Tits range. Currently in beta. I then asked him whether he thought sugar was addictive.
Anyone who's ever tried to stop eating sugar will tell you it's addictive because they feel like garbage. They have mood swings, they have depression, they have what's often called the sugar quitter's flu for 2 to 4 weeks. You don't get that when you give up on lettuce. It's only with sugar.
So best to stay away from Andy for the next few days as he comes down off this high, especially as he's currently trying to give up smoking after a previous episode. So... But set against a couple of weeks of discomfort, what are the consequences of not quitting?
The diseases which flow from consuming too much fructose are disastrous. It wrecks your organs one by one. They are now at truly epidemic levels. We've gone in Australia from having 200,000 people suffering from type 2 diabetes in the early 1980s to having 1.4 million suffering from them now. If I was talking about Ebola with those statistics, we'd all be hoarded up in our basement with a shotgun and a can of baked beans. But with type 2 diabetes, which today caused 9 people in Australia to lose a limb to amputation and will cause another 9 to lose one tomorrow and another 9 the day after that, that is just the tip of the iceberg. You add in similar statistics on fatty liver disease, cirrhosis of the liver, chronic kidney disease, heart disease, hypertension, all of those, adding those together, and there is no alternative view but that it is killing us and killing us swiftly.
Still, the good news is we are losing weight. The bad news is it's by losing limbs. Now, in Australia, David Gillespie is part of a growing anti-sugar movement, but I wondered if the industry is starting to take notice.
At the moment, what they're doing is starting to pay attention. There's an old rule in marketing, which is when 6% of your customers care about something, then you need to pay attention. And when 20% of your customers care about something, you need to change what you're doing. I think we're somewhere between 6 and 20% here because we're starting to see some brands coming out with low sugar versions or no sugar versions of their products. And that means that a lot of people care.
But is there a cover-up as such?
There are elements of the processed food industry, particularly the big end of town, and I'm talking the people who are making billions and billions of dollars a year out of this stuff. So the soft drink manufacturers, the confectionery manufacturers, the breakfast cereal manufacturers, they all know exactly what's going on. They are using plays from the tobacco playbook over and over and over again. Everything from sponsoring sort of front organizations to paying off experts like professors and dietitians and so on to getting involved in government discussions about these sorts of things. And you're seeing that over and over again in the United Kingdom as we are in Australia and as they are in the United States. Every now and then it sneaks its head to the surface and you see it in a newspaper headline, but it's there all the time. So that end of town know exactly what they're doing and they are trying very, very hard to slow down any move towards removing sugar.
The food industry is making a lot of money, but can we get a slice of the banoffee pie? That's the question. So I spoke to Merin Somerset Webb, editor of Money Week. Unfortunately, she couldn't join us live tonight because the life of a Money Week editor is impossibly glamorous and she's probably yachting in the Aegean or avoiding Prince Andrew on Mystique. But by satellite phone to her yacht, I started by asking whether there is any money to be made from investing in sugar.
Sugar is a little like tobacco a decade ago, 2 decades ago, in that the governments are just beginning to realise what an impact it has on health. And so just beginning to start talking about taxing sugar, taxing products with sugar in them, etc. So it's a dangerous area to start looking at the moment. So I'd be very careful investing in sugar.
And those rumblings you can hear from the stock market are Warren Buffett pulling out of wagon wheels. Can you really tax sugar?
Sure you can. I mean, you can tax anything you like. And already there's conversations about taxing, fizzy drinks, for example, which are, pure evil, aren't they, really? Fizzy drinks. Then you start taxing pure candy, you start taxing chocolates, and then next thing you know, you're taxing jam. So it's a slippery slope.
Well, of course, if it's jam, it's actually a sticky slope, which isn't nearly as dangerous. But what about investing in sugar alternatives?
But there are lots of interesting sugar substitutes out there which are worth looking at. I mean, some of them not very pleasant, some of them pleasant. There's one which I'm quite interested in called xylitol, which is produced by all sorts of people, actually, and it's derived from the bark of the birch tree. And the brilliant thing about it is that it has no effect on blood sugar at all. So if you eat pure xylitol, it has absolutely no effect on your blood sugar, which for diabetics, for example, is amazing and quite good for the rest of us.
If you're not a qualified biochemist, what about weight loss systems or liposuction as an investment?
Cosmetic surgery in general is booming, both in the UK and, you know, going abroad to get cheaper treatments. And so if you can find a way to invest in liposuction, I'm sure it'll be a fabulous investment going forward.
So Merin suggests you shy away from sugar as much financially as physically. But then professional investors like car mechanics do have a financial interest in lying to you. In this case, to keep all the sugar stocks for herself, perhaps. If she turns up to the third series in a tiara, we'll know we've been had. Let's go back to Andy. How are you feeling now, Andy?
Oh, I'm not blinking as much as I'd like. My insides are beating like a drum.
Nice.
Yeah.
Andy's body was a temple, ladies and gentlemen, but sugar has well and truly gone in and turned over all the tables. There's an old saying that sex sells, and in food terms, sugar is sex. It's there in fruit to make you eat fruit, because making you eat fruit is how certain plants reproduce. It's their plunging neckline. It's their pert buttocks. But lashing that appeal to every third-rate food product you want to shift or store or export has been an unmitigated disaster for mankind. And what was once a treat has become a fix, like any other, with health consequences to match. For simple economic gain, the food industry has shown utter disregard for people's health and the limits of their control. Arguably, they're even worse than tobacco. At least when you smoke, you look cool. No one looks cool eating a donut. And unlike drinking, you don't even have a memorable time. When you're eating sugar, you may have a brief dopamine rush, but you don't pluck up the courage to ask someone out, or indeed to ask someone outside, which does at least provide a good laugh for your mates. Invest in sugar by all means, but my guess is weight loss schemes are going to be a safe bet for many years to come. Invest soundly and maybe you can afford to go and live somewhere where the sugar occurs naturally and all you have to do is chew. So, what have we learned? Sugar is about as dangerous a substance as you can imagine, to the extent that it might be our best hope to beat Islamic State is a huge airdrop of trifles. If little girls really are made of sugar and spice and all things nice, they're going to die early from fatty liver disease. David Gillespie's tactic in an Ebola epidemic is to hole up with a tin of beans. He'd also take a shotgun, which isn't a bad idea, but I'd suggest a tin opener. We all know the dangers. After all, that's why we all know the lyrics, sweets for my sweet, sugar for my honey. I've got diabetes and my teeth have gone funny. Thank you very much. Good night. Listening to Simon Evans Goes to Market, where I was joined by Tim Harford, David Gillespie and Merin Somerset Webb. It was written by me, Simon Evans, with Guy Venables, Benjamin Partridge and Andy Walton, and the producer was Claire Jones. It was a BBC Radio comedy production.
And that was the last in the series of Simon Evans Goes to Market.